What's on the horizon for financial markets? At PGIM, it's a question that over 1,400 investment professionals relentlessly research in pursuit of your long-term goals. Specialized across asset classes, but united in collaboration, our teams provide global and local expertise. Our investments shape tomorrow, today. Pursue your tomorrow with PGIM, a leading global asset manager.
You're listening to The Exchange. Here's today's show.
Welcome, everybody. It's the last trading Friday of the year, and here's what's ahead today. Continuing progress, headway, we're not leaving without aid. We've heard all this talk out of Washington for the past several weeks, but things just got a lot more complicated with the Fed now getting thrown into the mix. We've got the details. Plus, a battle is brewing between Pfizer and the government over a lack of direction on vaccine shipments. We have the very latest on that. And a profitable IPO, support for Airbnb, and what happens if Discovery can't pull off a Disney Plus. It's all ahead this hour, but let's start with the markets. Bob Pisani has the very latest for us. Bob?
So we keep expecting the stimulus to pass. This was December 18th. We're supposed to have a deal by then, and we don't. And as you just heard there from Kelly, we hear complications associated now with the Fed in the negotiations. So the bottom line is we moved down in the middle of the morning as this realization came to pass. We're off of the lows, but it's still tough. Good news is we're up for the week a little more than 1%. Take a look at the sectors. Dow Jones Industrial Average ups down here, the S&P, but we were lower earlier in the morning. In terms of the sectors, see, here's the COVID winter story. The banks, the energy stocks, there's real estate. These are all associated with the problems we're going to be having in the next few months dealing with the pandemic here. Semis have had a very good week. Broadcom's at a new high. Retail's had a very good week. They just love buying any of these retail ETFs that trade and primarily do business online. Speaking of online, thematic tech ETFs in general today, again, that's one of the things holding the markets up. So solar stocks, anything associated with cybersecurity, cloud computing, e-sports, these every single day, people like to trade these stocks and like to own them. Another strange anomaly, you might think, given the fact that we've had this massive hack of the federal government, we're seeing cybersecurity stocks move to the upside, even though they have proved relatively ineffective in preventing us from being subject to these massive cyber attacks. Very serious what's going on with that hack into the U.S. government. Finally, big day for Tesla going into the S&P 500, $85 billion in Tesla stocks got to be bought at the close and likely a lot more than that. Tesla's already done 50 million shares. You're going to see a lot more than that, probably four times that much by the end of the day. Going into the S&P 500, along with the rebalancing and that quadruple witching today, bottom line, guys, we're going to see a lot of money moving around right at the close. And of course, hopefully, it's not going to reduce or change any share prices, but that's one of the concerns the market has. We'll be watching all of that right at 4 p.m. Eastern time. Guys, back to you.
I can't wait to see what happens, Bob. Thank you very much for now, our Bob Pisani. Okay. In the meantime, Congress is up against some key deadlines, but the COVID relief talks just hit another snag, this one involving the Federal Reserve and efforts by Senator Toomey to restrain their emergency COVID powers. Elon Moy is here with the very latest. Elon?
Well, Kelly, congressional leaders still say that they are close to a deal and that they're not leaving town until it's done.
Our bipartisan discussions are continuing to make significant headway toward another relief package for the American people. In fact, I'm even more optimistic now than I was last night that a bipartisan bicameral framework for a major rescue package is very close at hand.
But one of the final sticking points is this fight over the Federal Reserve and the emergency lending programs that it set up under the CARES Act. Now, those are supposed to shut down at the end of the year. But GOP Senator Pat Toomey is leading a push to prevent the Fed from ever restarting those programs again. And that is a big problem for Democrats. Virginia Senator Mark Warner said the proposal to pull back on the Fed's 13-3 authority would set a terrible precedent, hurt the Fed's independence, and weaken its ability to respond quickly to future crises. Now, Kelly, lawmakers are going to have to decide soon if they can overcome this obstacle and so many others and meet the midnight deadline. Otherwise, they will have to pass a stopgap funding measure to make sure that the government stays open. Back to you.
And Elon, Biden's economic advisor, Brian Deese, who will replace Larry Kudlow in that role when the administration turns over, is just saying that
The COVID-19 aid deal should not include provisions that would hamper Treasury and the Fed to fight economic crises. So again, sort of taking the side that we just heard from Mark Warner on that, I guess the question now is how much time is left and what are the odds of kind of the funding bill, just the government funding piece that's moving forward? And now what do you think the fate of the COVID relief bill is?
Yeah, there is just not a lot of time to get this done, especially if they're going to have to negotiate sort of over the ideological debate over the powers of the Federal Reserve. This language that Toomey has now proposed has sort of shifted over the past few months, and now this has become an issue just over the past 24 hours. But it's hard to see this being the one fly in the ointment that makes the lawmakers sort of miss that midnight deadline. There have been so many other fights, including over FEMA disaster money, over SNAP benefits as well. So there are a lot of little pieces that they're trying to tie together. And we have not yet heard any sound or any movement from Democrats in terms of what length of continuing resolution or stopgap funding measure they'd be willing to accept. Is it something that would just go through the weekend? Is it something that would butt up against Christmas? They have to make those decisions very soon. And we're hoping to hear from House Speaker Nancy Pelosi within the next hour and get a little bit of clarity.
Yeah, it doesn't sound that promising. Markets have reversed course, but they're not exactly selling off that sharply either. Elon, thanks as always for keeping us posted. Elon Moy in Washington. And as Congress continues its tug of war towards a stimulus deal, stocks are pulling back after all three major averages touched record highs this morning. You can see the major indexes, Dow and S&P down 0.5%, the NASDAQ only down 0.1% right now. I guess the larger question is a hangover looming after we get through the COVID talks and after Tesla finally goes into the S&P? On Monday. With us now are Daryl Cronk, president of the Wells Fargo Investment Institute. Sherry Paul is managing director of UBS Global Wealth Management, and it's good to have you guys both here. Daryl, are you surprised the markets aren't doing worse in response to what looks like kind of a mess right now on Capitol Hill as regards the COVID bill?
Yeah, what's the old Washington adage, Kelly, about, you know, when you reach a policy cliff, Washington builds more land, right? So that's probably what they're going to do this afternoon and into the weekend, is likely get a few more days by themselves, either through a short-term funding gap bill, or maybe they just shut the government down for a few days over the weekend and they get this thing done on Monday. But either way, what is going to happen, we think, in the next week is a $900 billion plus stimulus package, of which most of the components are already laid out and agreed upon, and then the $1.4 billion omnibus government spending package, which will keep the government funded and open through October 1st of 2021.
Yeah. And so, Sherry, in other words, this is just a little bit of a punt, kind of kick the can down the road into a couple of hours or a couple of days from now. I wonder, is it a bigger cliff potentially once Tesla goes into the S&P? And just because the shares are up 60% over the past month on this inclusion, if it's a buy the rumor, sell the fact event on Monday, it will be a headwind for the whole market.
Well, I think that we've got a lot going on, right? We've got some kicking and screaming here as we kind of end the year. And I think it's important from a political standpoint, I think it's important that we just quickly go back and understand that the human recovery has lagged the market recovery. And reconciling that, I think, also involves looking at, well, how did we get leg one of the recovery? And that was clearly through what was essentially bridge financing between the Fed and Congress, fiscal stimulus, money in the pocket of people to bridge their spending, that high unemployment number, businesses shutting down, and the Federal Reserve innovating through this pandemic in really impressive ways, including the PPE and providing the liquidity and stability to the system. As we move forward, the next leg of this market going higher will hinge on human recovery, which means vaccine distribution. And we have a timeline now for that. And so essentially this next round of stimulus is a second bridge financing to get us to that endpoint. We are in a temporary state within the pandemic. It's been brutal. It's been painful for people. It is a temporary state. We want to help investors now look beyond to where we sit today, the sausage making in D.C., to the second half of next year, and start to tilt their portfolios towards the human recovery, which puts you in cyclical small caps. And even to some degree preparing, dare I say, for, longer term potential inflation down the road.
You can go ahead and say it. I think the 30-year inflation break-evens just climbed above 2% today, but the bond market's still kind of shrugging that off. Right. So, Daryl, let me just circle back to you then with a kind of note on that. I mean, are we all going to be caught, you know, flat-footed, wrong-footed if we start to see that, you know, bond yields go up and these high-flying tech trades come back down to earth or not? Because it seems like everyone's been anticipating that for the last several months now, and it's just not quite happening.
Well, I think bond yields are slowly grinding higher. We expect the 10-year to break 1% and continue that steepening yield curve, which is why financials are working, industrials are working, materials are working. So I actually think, though, the thing that people are underappreciating here on today's activity and into next week is Santa Claus may yet be coming to town as quick as next week for a number of reasons. One is you've got all these hedges through quadruple witching that are rolling off today. That leaves a lot of street balance sheets flat on, without getting too technical, what's called gamma, which means if you still believe in the risk-on trade, which most do, they've got to put that gamma back on. So you could have a year-end rally here, we think, into the next couple weeks that may surprise on low volume, which is typical for this time
Daryl,
of year.
I mean, I was going to say, Santa Claus is already here. You know, this has been a pretty remarkable move the last couple of weeks. I mean, you tell me, but it seems like we talked about this a lot more yesterday, but the momentum trades, the Teslas, the EV stocks, you know, you throw big tech in there. Tech software ETF was an all-time high yesterday. Momentum ETF was an all-time high yesterday. Bitcoin, I mean, Santa, to the extent that that's kind of what the year-end rally is about, is here. So it's interesting, though, what you say about gamma and positioning. So you're just saying there's still a little bit more fuel to this fire.
Absolutely. I mean, Santa Claus, you could argue, came in November, right, on a huge monthly rally for the month of November, but it's going to stay with us. And remember, this time of year, you get into low volume. If dealers and big balance sheets on the street find themselves short risk heading into this year end, I don't think that's a place they want to be. And I think they'll probably put more risk on, which on that low volume probably means you push indices higher. You get the Tesla rebalancing. You get new hedges being put on. To Bob Pisani's earlier point, $85 billion has to rotate into higher tech, right? So that's all going to play in the back half, in the next 2 weeks of this year.
Fascinating. We have to leave it there, guys. Sorry, but I appreciate your thoughts. Daryl Cronk and Sherry Paul talking us through what to expect in the next weeks and then into next year on the market. Coming up, Pfizer says it has millions of doses of its COVID-19 vaccine sitting in a warehouse, but no government instructions on where it should go. HHS is saying that's not true. We're going to look at the vaccine battle next. Plus, another day, another IPO filing, but this one stands out. Why? It's profitable. That story in a few. Stay with us.
This is The Exchange on CNBC.
Electricity, a big idea that's inspired countless new ones, from powering the light bulb to virtually powering our entire lives. 30 years ago, State Street launched the Spider S&P 500 ETF, SPY, a big idea that inspired the world to invest differently, and still does. What can you do with SPY?
Before investing, consider the fund's investment objectives, risks, charges, and expenses. Visit SSGA.com for a prospectus containing this and other information. Read it carefully before investing. SPY is subject to risks similar to those of stocks. All ETFs are subject to risk, including possible loss of principal. Alps Distributors, Inc. Distributor.
Welcome back. Pfizer's vaccine rollout has hit a major snag as states say their supplies are getting cut. Officials in California, Washington, Hawaii, and Nevada say the CDC informed them their allocations will be slashed by about 40%, but no explanation was provided as to why. And about a dozen other states say they were told to expect fewer doses as well. Pfizer says it has plenty of supply on hand, quote, saying no shipments containing the vaccine are on hold or delayed. Pfizer says it has millions of doses ready to be shipped out. Here to help us get to the bottom of it, we welcome our own Meg Terrell, along with Dr. Waleed Jalad, who is Associate Professor of Medicine at the University of Pittsburgh. Welcome to both of you. And Meg, let's just start with what do we know at this hour about why these states are finding their expectations and their supplies cut?
Well, we're getting sort of conflicting messages, really, out of the administration. They note, bottom line, they still expect 20 million people to be able to get their first shot within December, assuming that the Moderna vaccine gets emergency use authorization today or tomorrow, as everybody expects it will. But the states, many states reporting 30-50% cuts in their allocations of Pfizer's vaccine for next week. Some messaging that that might just be a mix-up. They were essentially given some old numbers for a training protocol, and now the real numbers are turning out to be less. But then there has been this back and forth between the administration and Pfizer, where there have been some suggestions, including from, you know, Governor Ron DeSantis, who, of course, is not part of the administration, but made the assertion that Florida's allocation was cut because of Pfizer's manufacturing issues. So Pfizer then has come out and said it has no manufacturing issues. And in fact, it has more doses available than have actually been they've been told what to do with, Kelly.
Fascinating. So, Dr. Jalad, what is your sort of take on all of this as it continues to play out in very public view?
Having me on, I think that is the issue, that it's playing out in public view. You know, if you take a step back, what's happened with Operation Warp Speed is really amazing when you think about the science and then the logistics. You know, we're going to have by Christmas two vaccines for this disease we've never seen before in people's arms. I think the issue now is communication. And with an operation that is so big, there's going to be disagreements, there's going to be miscommunications. And the issue now is that this is playing out in public. So I often, you know, I was thinking earlier about D-Day, okay, an enormous operation. Imagine if all of that had been playing out in public on Twitter, on cable news. So I think this kind of issue is going to be common with a huge operation, but we're just seeing it really play out in front of us.
So, Dr. Jalad, what do you think is going on here? I mean, it's a difficult issue because in some ways, you know, who are the states supposed to complain? I mean, do they complain to the government? Do they complain to Pfizer? They probably have to communicate to their own populations who are of hospitals and nursing homes and vulnerable frontline workers who were expecting that they were going to get vaccinated next week and now are hearing that that's no longer possible. So I can kind of understand why they're saying, hey, wait a minute. We didn't screw this up. Something's changing here, right?
Absolutely. Everybody is under tremendous pressure from all sides. And you mentioned then the hospitals, up to the states, up to Operation Warp Speed, up to Pfizer. I think this is a matter of communication. And the problem for hospitals and others who are vaccinating, like you mentioned, is that they have a lot of planning to do. They've set some expectations with their staff. They've probably scheduled appointments already. So for them, they're going to have to go and then tell people that we might have to delay it a week. So at each step, there are delays, and everybody is on edge, I think. And so I think the issue is really the communication between the hospitals and the states and the federal government. And they really need to get their act in order in terms of communication.
You know, Meg, what are we missing? If Pfizer says it has full supplies and the states are somehow being told that the supplies they expected weren't coming in, were they given overly optimistic numbers in the first place that are now being brought back down to earth? Or is there some other reason why the supply wouldn't be available?
Well, there are sort of multiple things going on. One was that we are hearing that the states were originally given some sort of just placeholder numbers and that these numbers turn out to be different for what they're actually getting allocated. And some explanation of that is just that they want to establish sort of a steady cadence of dose shipments. But the backdrop of this, Kelly, that's sort of important because it explains, I think, the back and forth we're seeing between HHS and Pfizer is that they are in a negotiation right now over getting more doses of Pfizer's vaccine next year for the second quarter. And there is some apparent, you know, almost bad blood, it seems like, where you're hearing Secretary Alex Azar talking about Pfizer being secretive. Pfizer CEO was on our air Monday morning saying that they would like for the government to use the Defense Production Act to help them acquire more raw materials, which some of which are running at critical supply, they said. And the original story was that Pfizer had offered that second quarter allotment of vaccine doses to the U.S. before selling them to other countries, and that the U.S. didn't exercise that option. Now it wants the doses in the second quarter, and it can't get them until the third quarter. The administration disputes that timeline, Kelly, and says they weren't actually made a formal offer. But now the argument is, can Pfizer somehow speed up the development for the second quarter? And that's where this, you know, bubbling up is happening, it seems like.
Absolutely. And Dr. Jalal, just a final question on that note. People are starting to ask, if the vaccines do work so well after the first dose and we're having some of these shortage problems, would it be better to just do a first round of a vaccine and hit twice the population?
That is a question people should be asking, right? But the dosage is really two doses. So no one should be going around and saying we're only going to do one dose. The issue really is, how much does the government keep in warehouse to make sure everyone gets that second dose on time versus taking a little risk that that second dose can be delayed and vaccinating millions more people? So the issue is not whether people should get one or two doses. The issue is whether we can somehow get more people that first dose now, because we are at the peak of this pandemic. It is horrible. And there is really reason to believe that that first dose can have an impact, even if it's not the ideal, even if it's not the full protection.
Yeah.
So that's what
and
needs
on that
to be.
Note,
no, I'm good. Yeah. I'm good. Thank you. That's the issue that needs to be discussed.
Absolutely. I was just going to say on that note, we do potentially have a whole lot more headed our way as the Moderna vaccine also starts being dispersed. Dr. Waleed Jalal, thank you so much. And our Meg Terrell as well, thanks to you for helping to explain what's been going on with this rollout. And while it does offer a return to hope or hope for a return to normal, I should say, in 2021, it's going to be a much longer road to recovery for the airline stocks than you might think. A new article on CNBC Pro is detailing this. It's been a rough year for the carriers, which have lost more than $20 billion. United Airlines, the worst performer, still down 48%. Southwest, the relative outperformer, it's only down 15%. But you can get the full deep dive on this story and the fate of the airlines at cnbc.com/pro. Coming up, new data shows institutional investors started a Bitcoin buying spree earlier this year, picking up more than $11 billion worth of the crypto in 3 months. Is it the start or the end of the trend? We'll explore that. Plus, all the focus has been on Pfizer and Moderna this week, but there's another healthcare name out there that's outperformed them both, and by a lot. Our Friday Find is next. Don't forget, you can always watch us live on the go using the CNBC app. We're back in a couple.
CNBC has quick and easy to understand business news updates at the open, midday, and close every weekday. Markets, money, and more from Wall Street to Main Street. I'm CNBC's Jessica Ettinger. Follow and listen to CNBC Business News Updates wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to The Exchange. Watching these markets closely this afternoon with both stimulus talks uncertain and this big rebalance on the close with Tesla and the quad witching looming. Dow and the S&P down about 0.5% right now after retreating from record highs this morning. The Nasdaq down 0.2%. Only one sector is positive right now, and that's materials by about 0.1%. Worst sectors today, financials down 1%. Real estate down there as well. Energy down 1.6. Here are some of the movers this hour. Shares of Winnebago are climbing after reporting a strong beat on both the top and bottom line. The RV maker says it sees interest in outdoor activity strengthening even more next year. Investors are buying it up 7%. Scholastic lower on disappointing earnings and revenue for the second quarter. It declined to issue 2021 guidance, citing the uncertainty of COVID-19's future impact on schools. Makes sense. Scholastic shares are down 9%. And shares of CrowdStrike are climbing as the scale of the massive hack of the U.S. government continues to grow. Analysts saying cybersecurity firms like CrowdStrike and Zscaler and, ironically, FireEye could see gains as companies and governments work to shore up their systems. CrowdStrike is up 9% right now on a strong day for all the cyber names. Let's get to Morgan Brennan now for a CNBC News update. Hi, Morgan.
Hey, Kelly. So I am Morgan Brennan. Here's your CNBC News update at this hour. In Georgia, turnout remains near record levels in the runoff elections for two U.S. Senate seats. More than 1.1 million people have voted so far, just below the total at the same point in the November election. Deaths from drug overdoses have risen to a new record. CDC says there were 81,000 overdose deaths in the 12 months ending in May, and that the rise was driven in part by disruptions in daily life due to the pandemic. And in South Korea, a man who spent 20 years in jail for a crime he didn't commit is finally having his name cleared. He was released on parole in 2009, but had to wait until now to be declared innocent. A judge apologized to him on behalf of the judiciary for the pain caused by that wrong verdict. That's your CNBC News update for this hour. Kelly, back to you.
Still more than 81,000 overdoses this year.
It's heartbreaking. I mean,
it's so sad. And we're just going into the winter again now.
That's right. It's very sad. And certainly our hearts go out to the folks that are touched by this. So many people are touched by this.
100%. Yeah. Morgan, appreciate it. Morgan Brennan back at headquarters. Let's get to our Friday find now. It's a stock that's had a nice rally this week without much fanfare. While all the attention has been on Pfizer and Moderna, take a look at shares of Sage Therapeutics. The stock is up 17% this week after announcing a new CEO. The move was a surprise to Wall Street, but was well received by analysts. Wedbush saying the move is a positive one for the company that should resonate with investors and brings a seasoned but fresh view at the top. Sage adding another 4% today. It hit a 52-week high last month, and it's up more than 200% from its 52-week low. Coming up, the IPO craze continues, but the latest company stands out. We'll tell you why. The Disney Discovery downgrade, dashing to buy DoorDash, and the Cyberpunk debacle. It's all ahead in rapid fire. We're back in a couple. Welcome back. Let's catch you up on a couple stories that should be on your radar today. It is time for Rapid Fire. Here to break down the headlines are Michael Santoli, Deirdre Bosa, and CNBC contributor Ed Lee. He is the corporate media reporter at the New York Times. Welcome, everybody. Let's begin with Poshmark today, another IPO. It's filing to go public, but interestingly, after turning profitable during the pandemic, in the first three quarters of last year, Poshmark lost more than $30 million. Different story now, though, with the secondhand e-commerce marketplace turning a profit of more than $20 million since January. Ed, that should be enough to give them a $20 billion valuation.
Well, look, we're all living in lockdown, and I think people are, you know, they're cleaning out their closets and trying to find ways to make a little extra money. So I think there was probably sort of a positive bump from that. The downside risk, though, for me on this particular company, when you have that kind of a marketplace where you're buying and selling things, you don't control your inventory, right? So once we come out of lockdown and people come going back out into stores and stuff, you know, they're going to have a harder time controlling how much inventory they can bring in and out, and which ultimately will determine their sales. I mean, eBay had sort of issues a while ago, which is why they just sort of went to becoming an e-commerce company. So that, I think, is right. Something to look out for post-COVID.
Deirdre, I experimented with some of these sort of secondhand, what do you call marketplaces, used clothes, online warehouse, whatever we're calling them. And I mean, the waiting times right now are astronomical. They're basically saying, you know, give us 6 months. And we'll tell you what this stuff is worth if you choose, you know, the kind of easiest option. So they're flooded right now, although I take Ed's point longer term.
Right. I guess the point is, you know, will people continue to use this post-pandemic? And Kelly, why did you stop at $20 billion? If an $18 billion company like Airbnb can be worth nearly $100 billion, the sky's the limit. In all seriousness, though, showing that kind of profitability should probably be really appealing to investors right now. And it's kind of remarkable where we've come in this moment versus last year at this time when we had just watched the implosion of WeWork and we heard Wall Street saying you need to show profitability. But in the last few months, right, and with how hot the IPO market, it seems like there's a lot more appetite for growth. That said, what was it, 28% in the first three quarters of 2020 for Poshmark? Is that going to be enough?
And Mike, Poshmark reminds me a little bit of Instacart if they, you know, are waiting in the wings as well here as names that investors have to decide. Okay, is the fact that they benefited so much from the pandemic a reason why they're more attractive long term or just a convenient excuse for them to come out with a nice valuation?
Yeah, well, we're living in the golden age of middleman apps. You mentioned, I mean, Airbnb, DoorDash, Poshmark, it's all the same thing. It's a dispatch app. And I think that the economics of it are great if you do have that sustainably growing network effect. And now, Kelly, you know I have a proprietary channel checks I can do for younger
consumers.
I do. Depop is actually the choice of under 24-year-olds. It's a Poshmark equivalent. It's
Depop?
The same kind. Depop. And Poshmark, I heard, you know what, that's a little more for millennials, which means the older people.
My daughters,
just to be clear.
I drive a minivan. I've accepted it. But I am looking. I just want to know where the buyers are. Mike, because that's where I'm going to sell everything.
Right.
All right. Speaking of you got to keep up with Santoli. He keeps us all on our toes around here.
Let's talk some Discovery.
Exactly. That's all you need to be. Discovery could become a casualty of the streaming wars, warns Bank of America. The firm is dropping its rating on the stock from buy to underperform and cutting its price target to $25 a share. That's 11% lower from here. They're saying it'll be challenging to produce must-have content in this fragmented media landscape. Granted, Discovery is down about 3% today, but coming off a six-week winning streak. That's its longest winning streak since last summer. And I find this fascinating. They were an absolute winner, monster of the cable era. Can it transition now into streaming?
So like, I think Discovery's long-term genius during this whole cable period was that it was effectively background TV, right? It was sort of always on. You know, you walked into any household, like someone was watching one of the Discovery's networks. It's easy to watch. The content itself is relatively cheap to produce. And they made a lot of money on advertising. The problem when you go streaming, when you go direct to consumer, is that's a lean forward activity, right? To use sort of these early internet terms. It doesn't have the same dynamic. So I think that's going to be a huge, huge challenge. I mean, I think, you know, the estimates are they're doing $7 ARPU, right? Average revenue per user on the linear network, 80 million households doing it. Trying to convert that onto streaming is going to be really, really hard. Also, they're not taking their current linear stuff onto streaming. They have to produce all new stuff for streaming, right? And so they've got two different masters now where they have to spend on both ends of this. I think it's going to be tough.
Yeah. And there's a lot of Discovery properties individually that I really like, and I use some of the free apps, and I'm excited for the Magnolia channel and all of that. But, you know, this one does seem to be at risk of not becoming one of the big four, right? Like, I've talked about this, but if you've got Netflix out there, if you've got Disney Plus, you kind of only have room for a couple more, I think, and it's going to be a really tight race between Peacock and HBO Max and Discovery and all these different platforms for that prime property.
It almost feels as if, now, first of all, Discovery is a very, very cheap stock. So the market is not sitting there embedding high hopes for the streaming strategy in the valuation. I think that's the upside here, is that it already looks like the market's priced it for, you know, decline over time. So it's not like you have to worry about that mismatch. But I think you're absolutely right. You almost wonder if Discovery ends up getting more folded into a new version of the bundle, whether it is just kind of native on some cell phone services, whatever you might have to do, or just being kind of agglomerated with some other players, as opposed to just being the, you know, the content that people are going to be talking about and getting other people to sign up for, which is the Netflix, HBO Max, Disney model.
It's almost like Disney Plus is so successful that everybody else has to, like, well, you said team up and combine in order. I mean, 350 million subs, if they're right, is just incredible. All right, let's talk about some of these recent IPOs, DoorDash and Airbnb. If you think their valuations are too rich right now, well, Susquehanna does not. They just became the biggest bull on the street for both of these recent IPOs. The firm initiating coverage on both with a positive rating and street high price targets, saying they each dominate their respective markets. Shares of both, by the way, up about 6% today. Susquehanna sees Airbnb going to 180 a share. They see DoorDash hitting 185. Deirdre, that's about 15% upside for each stock.
When you think about what these businesses are doing right now, yes, that seems crazy. If you think about what they can do in the future, maybe that makes sense, because you're assuming that Airbnb and DoorDash, they're not always going to be home sharing and delivery platforms, that you're basically betting that DoorDash is going to become more than that, a logistics network with its own potentially convenience stores, or Airbnb is going to end up controlling its whole ecosystem, which, by the way, it sort of already does, right? That 90% stat of traffic is all organic. So what does Airbnb do with that? Does it look into advertising, property management? And in that sense, these companies will become platforms in the same sense that some of our tech giants are. So I suppose that is the bull case. And we're hearing that from Susquehanna, but certainly there's more analysts out there who think that these valuations are just out of control.
Yeah. And Mike, is there anything you would add to that? I mean, just in terms of, I don't know, some color around the Susquehanna move here. I mean, to some extent, they're kind of just recognizing what's happened over the past week, you know, not going out on a limb saying these things are going to double, but also not saying they're going to fall 50%. And that's kind of what you would expect from the street.
Pretty much. And it leaning on the fact that they are category leaders, at least at this moment. I also always enjoy looking at what companies the analysts want these to be compared to for valuation purposes. And when it came to Airbnb, it was not the other online travel booking companies because they don't seem pricey enough. So it was Roku and Shopify and Snap and Trade Desk and all these other really hot growth concepts. And that kind of tells you where people think they can go. I think there's a big test in the public markets is, can the venture capital idea of just be the leader, spend to grow, and essentially put the competition out of business with unending capital spending and reinvestment, can that work in the context of a public company? That's what's the experiment going on.
Yeah, very well stated. Very well stated. All right, finally, and this is really why we have Edley here today, in a move that's shocking the gaming community, Sony is removing the highly anticipated video game Cyberpunk 2077 from its PlayStation store and offering full refunds for digital copies. This after the game has had all this criticism because of bugs and poor performance on older consoles, and no one can get their hands on a newer console right now. Microsoft's Xbox also offering refunds of the game, says it won't delist it just yet. They realize some players have been unhappy, they say, with the current experience. Ed, I know you're all over this one, all over Cyberpunk 2077.
Well, you think I'm just at home playing video games all day? That's why, right? It's like I've got CNBC on one side and video games on the other with my computer. No, this is kind of unprecedented. This is a really huge sort of recall, really. It's equivalent of what this is. And, you know, we can't think of games anymore as just sort of this weird hobby thing that younger people are doing. It's absolutely a huge part of the entertainment sort of kind of industrial complex, so to speak. We're talking about, you know, Discovery and Netflix and Disney Plus. Video games are as much a part of sort of the viewing, right, sort of time that consumers are using. And it's not just kids at home, it's adults as well. So this is, it's a big black mark. I also think it tells you, you know, the way it's reverberated again is how important video games are to the entertainment industry. I have yet to see sort of Netflix or one of these other guys try to make more inroads into that. I think that's the next step. You know, Amazon has Twitch, and I think that's sort of a smaller part of that. But look for more convergence there going into the future. That's what I think.
Absolutely. No, you're absolutely right, Mike. And it's a reminder that it's not just Discovery competing against Netflix and Disney Plus. Video games are a massive, I mean, it almost makes me feel like it's a disservice to call them video games. Like, it's so much bigger than that.
Yeah, everyone's going for the same pool of eyeball hours, I guess is the way to put it. One thing this also accentuates, though, is that day when everything can just be kind of an online game and it's not going to be console-based keeps getting pushed out into the perpetual horizon, because one of the issues right here was this, the older games can't really play this sort of graphics-rich type content, and that edge just keeps getting pushed. So I think it's kind of fascinating about the power of the actual game consoles as well.
And that's a bull case for all the video game ecosystem right there, for Microsoft, for Sony, and all the rest of it. We'll leave it there, guys. Thank you all. Michael Santoli, Dear Jabosa, and yes, Ed Lee joining us for Rapid Fire today. Coming up, the Bitcoin bonanza, cryptocurrency doubling in the past 3 months, and there was one investor group in particular that has helped to drive these gains. Those details right after this quick break. Welcome back. A monster week for Bitcoin. It's up 26% since Monday. It's on pace for its best week in more than a year. We're up back near 23,000 again, and it's doubled in the past 3 months. And that's been driven by wealthy investors. Kate Rooney is here with those details for us. Hi, Kate.
Hey, Kelly. Big investors who are new to cryptocurrencies may be behind this recent rally. According to data from blockchain firm Chainalysis, there's been a surge in demand from people who hold at least $20 million worth of Bitcoin and are new to the market with an account open for less than a year. Investors that met that criteria have bought $11.5 billion worth of Bitcoin since September. That buying spree coincides with the price of Bitcoin doubling. Analysts say this demand from wealthy and institutional investors is a big factor boosting Bitcoin to an all-time high this week. Some of these better-known investors have been pretty vocal about backing Bitcoin. Paul Tudor Jones and Stan Druckenmiller, as well as some others, have highlighted Bitcoin as a hedge against inflation in their own portfolios. That's bringing some new confidence to the asset class. With new demand, there's also lower supply. Chainalysis reports that people are selling about 800,000 less Bitcoins than they were 3 years ago. There's also some new celebrity intrigue this week. Right as Bitcoin hit its all-time high yesterday, rapper Megan Thee Stallion tweeted a crypto giveaway with Square Cash App that was retweeted by Square CEO Jack Dorsey. But as one economist pointed out, celebrity endorsements aren't always a good thing. They've typically been a bellwether for the top of the market. Kelly, back to you.
So true, Kate, although part of what you said about the sort of small supply base is so interesting because a lot of retail investors are sitting there with now gains, presumably even if they've been underwater for the last few years, that they're suddenly going, okay, maybe I just hang on to this thing for some time. And that's one of the bull cases for Bitcoin, is that there's just not a ton of supply available.
Right. There are some people hanging on from even 3 years ago when it did see its last all-time high. And then there's folks, even some of these institutional investors, instead of having it on an exchange where they're going to sell it, they often will put it into what's called cold storage, put it on something like a hard drive, and keep it away from exchanges for security reasons. So that's also draining some of that supply.
Cold storage, that's what they're calling it?
Cold storage, like a floppy disk or a hard drive. I don't know if floppy disks are still around,
exactly.
But one of those USB. USB.
Yeah, the more old school, the better.
Exactly.
Thumb drives, 100%.
Yes, that's
especially with all the hacking that's been going on lately. Broadly speaking, not in this case. Kate, thanks so much. Kate Rooney with the very latest for us on who is snapping up Bitcoin, which is surging this week to record highs. Coming up, what a scene this was. Distributors working fast and furiously to transfer tiny vaccine vials into specific packaging to keep it safe and stable. Next, we're going to speak with the company that made all the packaging for Pfizer's vaccine, and we'll be working with Moderna. We're back in a couple. Welcome back. Companies are working around the clock to deliver Pfizer's COVID vaccine. The packaging is crucial to keeping these millions of doses stable and super cold. Our Brian Sullivan traveled down to Shreveport, Louisiana this week to show us how this packaging is done. The company behind it has to do it all over again when Moderna's vaccine is granted emergency use authorization. Joining me now is Brian McCoy. He's president of Cold Chain Solutions at Sigma Supply of North America. Brian, it's good to have you. And you guys basically have to get all this packaging ready before you get that official go from the government, right?
Yeah, good afternoon, Kelly. Thank you for having me on. Yeah, so timing on this is crucial because we have to have it ready before we even know if it's approved. Normally, you have about 14 days to do a project like this. With the design, not really knowing exactly what the vials were going to be, we had about 3 days. And we knew we didn't want to be the reason that the community did not get the vaccine. So there was lots of late night text, emails, Zoom meetings to make sure that we were there when the vaccine arrived.
How did you become the go-to provider for this packaging?
So we do cold chain solutions. Sigma Supply, we're a national packaging distributor out of Hot Springs. We're a woman-owned family business. We're celebrating our 50th year in business this year. So we're familiar with it, and being Morrison Dixon is a close customer of ours. They called us up and said, can you help us? And we said, absolutely. Whatever you need, we will do.
And how does this rank in terms of projects for you guys? Is it on the small, medium, or larger size?
Stress, large, volume, it's what we do. So yeah, stressful, it was up there just because of the timing and everything like that. But everything else, this is right in line with what we do every single day. So we were just doing our job.
Yeah. So let's talk a little bit about the packaging for Pfizer and the packaging for Moderna. They're different. The vial sizes are different. Pfizer's has to be sold much more coldly. So how does that complicate your ability to roll these out and kind of get all of these vaccines where they need to go and where they need to go without any jostling, shall we say, along the way?
Right. Yeah. So luckily we did the Pfizer and it was the ultra cold. So we had to make sure that we had a product that would withstand the ultra cold temperatures. But not only do that, we needed it to be able to protect the vials themselves during transportation. And we really didn't want anything to be able to touch it. So we fully encompassed the foam around the vials. Not only that, you had the other, we had to unpack these in 3 minutes. So it had to be a user-friendly foam for the Pfizer. Moderna, it is a little bit larger vial. We've already made the adjustments we need for that, and we're just waiting on the word that we can move forward with that project.
There is not always user-friendly foam in my experience with these packages, so I can imagine. Brian, last question. What about getting compensated for this? I mean, is it like build like a normal project? Is it a totally different story because it's kind of this huge government, you know, kind of war against the pandemic thing? And I can only imagine when you need to get this supply up and running quickly, you know, your own costs are probably elevated.
Yeah, we treat it just as any other sale that we do, any other project. We treat it the same way. We're not looking for anything. I mean, yes, there was some expediting on our part, but we did what we needed to do to take care of it.
Fair enough. Brian, it's great to have you here and kind of hear the inside story of what's been going on. We take so much of this part of the supply chain for granted, but especially with these vaccines and what's required to distribute them, I think everyone's extra aware of what goes into it. Thanks for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having us. It was an honor to do this for everyone.
Yeah, and our thanks very much as well.
Thank you.
A lot of names hitting all-time highs in nearly all industries today. Before we go, take a quick look in gaming, Activision Blizzard at an all-time high, and fast food, Chipotle at an all-time high today. In retail, Nike and Estee Lauder before turning lower. In the payment space, PayPal and Paycheck. And in tech, Broadcom, Autodesk, and Oracle all hitting all-time highs today as we close out the last trading Friday of the year. That does it for us here on The Exchange. But ahead on Power Lunch, the suspected Russian hack is much worse than first feared. What you need to know and what could be coming next, I'll join Tyler Matheson for that after this quick break.
You've been listening to The Exchange. Make sure you're subscribed to get each episode every day, same time, same place.
CNBC has quick and easy to understand business news updates at the open, midday, and close every weekday. Markets, money, and more from Wall Street to Main Street. I'm CNBC's Jessica Ettinger. Follow and listen to CNBC Business News Updates wherever you get your podcasts.